Episode 37, November the 21st, 2010. Progress of Science Through the Ages. Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit amateur astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurbir Singh, an amateur astronomer based in the UK. For more information, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org. It's not often I get to personally witness the scientific method in real life. Recently, Professor Jim Al-Khalili was to give three lectures in Liverpool all on the same day: quantum physics, advances in mathematics in medieval Islam, and on the shoulders of Eastern giants, the forgotten contribution of the medieval physicists. I did feel a bit of a stalker. I attended all three, but fortunately I was not alone. The most illuminating part of the day of the three lectures was the Q&A of the second lecture. A questioner put her hand up and stated clearly that she had a correction rather than a question. She had heard the professor talk about the concept and symbol of the number zero. During his lecture, the professor had recalled the contribution from the Babylonians, Mayans, and Indian mathematicians. The questioner had been researching the substantial contribution from the Egyptians in this area, but the professor had not mentioned. What happened next was an affirmation of the scientific method. The professor could have been defensive, confrontational, or dismissive. Instead, he listened to her argument, asked her to stay behind so he could learn the details of her research. That is the power of the scientific idea. It stands only on the edifice of evidence, and not the economic wealth, social position, or academic reputation of those who hold it. The progress of scientific knowledge is not continuous and linear, but evolves through a series of stops and starts. Thomas Kuhn, in his 1962 book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, describes the progress of science as periodic paradigm shifts. He was referring to the fundamental differences in thinking that have led to the leaps in scientific understanding. Could that stop and start concept describe how science develops through the ages too? Scientific discoveries are frequently lost, forgotten, or deliberately suppressed. So, the story of scientific discovery is frequently a story of rediscovery. William Harvey's discovery in 1628 of the human heart and circulation of the blood through the human body had much in common with that of Ibn al-Nafis 400 years earlier. Nicholas Copernicus is credited in the 16th century with introducing the heliocentric system, placing the sun, not the earth, at the center of the solar system. But this idea had been propounded by Aristarchus in the 3rd century BC. The omissions are not just in science. One example of technological development lost for over 1,000 years that sticks out like a sore thumb is the Antikythera mechanism, a device for calculating and displaying relative positions of the sun, moon, and planets. The precision of the internal mechanism would not be repeated for over 1,000 years. Why these omissions occur is unclear. History, like science, is always a work in progress. Reflecting on why the ancient Greek tradition of the scientific method stalled, Carl Sagan, in his celebrated work Cosmos, concluded that their society was elitist and self-serving. Key figures like Plato were hostile to experiment and perpetuated the idea that human thought alone was sufficient to explain the physical world. This intellectually corrupt approach sustained their slave-owning, unjust society. Search for truth was not their goal. In his new book, Pathfinders, Professor Jim Al-Khalili attempts to fill a gap in the history of science by revisiting the work done by the Arabic scholars during the period known in Europe as the Dark Ages. It is not a story of Islamic science, but of science conducted in the Arabic language, which has its roots in Islam. For around 600 years, from the 9th to the 15th century, sandwiched between Greek and Latin, the international language of science was Arabic. A professor of theoretical nuclear physics at the University of Surrey, he was born in Baghdad to a Christian mother and a Muslim father. As an atheist, Jim Al-Khalili emphasizes the role of Islamic, Persian, Christian, and Jewish scholars who not only translated the work of the ancient Greeks, but enhanced and developed it. Just as the ancient Greeks took the concept of the alphabet from the earlier Phoenician civilization and developed the written language, the scientific discovery we traditionally associated with the European Renaissance were built in turn on the progress during this golden age of Arabic science. Professor Jim Al-Khalili has his own podcast, but here is a recording we made for this one just prior to the start of his 3-lecture session. To start off with, I asked him about his personal interest in astronomy.
I guess like most kids who end up going into science or engineering, astronomy is one of those things that interests me. Strangely enough, it was my younger brother who had the telescope, who was into the dinosaurs and that sort of thing. I think I was probably more preoccupied with football and girls. but at some point, I think in my early teens, I decided wanting to know about the world, the universe, and how things worked was what I decided was my direction in life.
And when was the last time, for example, when you actually looked through it, an optical telescope?
Ah, interestingly, only about 2 or 3 weeks ago. the Mill Hill Observatory, is it? The University College London. I'm filming a series at the moment for BBC Four, and part of the story is to talk about evidence for expansion of the universe. So we went along, met up with astronomers there, and I got to look at through the telescope, and I saw Andromeda. And I was very excited.
Your book, Pathfinders. Yes. You describe it as something that fills in a missing link in the history of science. There's been perhaps the most celebrated example of missing links was the Antikythera mechanism.
Yes.
This incredibly complicated engineering mechanism which was lost for about 1,000 years. So these things aren't new. Why do you think that that gap appeared in the first place?
It's interesting how science develops. I mean, the Antikythera mechanism is now believed to probably go back to the time of Archimedes or thereabouts. But we sort of know that the Greeks were very clever. We know that they were wonderful scientists and philosophers, people like Archimedes and Aristotle and Ptolemy and so on. But most in the West don't know about their counterparts in medieval times. There's this big gap, essentially, between Ptolemy and then Copernicus, well over 1,000 years later. It's as though the world of science stagnated for over a millennium, and that just wasn't the case.
Why do you think that was the case? Why is there a gap?
Well, I think certainly during the European Renaissance and the scientific revolution in Europe, what we now call sort of modern science, that got kick-started because they had available to them many texts from the Islamic world, mainly through Andalusia, through Spain, and they translated a lot of these Arabic scientific texts into Latin. But at some point, you know, once you get the sort of the Galileos and Newtons and Keplers coming along, what they did was so brilliant that it sort of superseded and wiped out a lot of previous history, and the Islamic world itself forgot its own heritage, scientific heritage. So it's no one's to blame for this. It's just the way ideas have developed.
Could it be, in a sense, there wasn't the kind of
publicity and publications and the champions of communications. For example, you hold part of your responsibility is the public understanding of science. There wasn't that thrust of public and science in that period, perhaps?
No, I guess not. I mean, it was very much these medieval scholars were working in sort of the courts of the caliphs, and they were getting the patronage from the wealthy sultans and rulers around the Islamic world. But it wasn't part of their culture to try and convince the wider population of the importance of what they're doing. And so it ceased to be something that could be carried through culturally.
If I talk about just one of your many heroes that you talk about, Ibn al-Haytham, who described so much of the theory of optics that we're familiar with now 1,000 years ago. And during that time, there was a great deal of work being done with lenses for spectacles and magnifying glasses and so on. So that period of the Islamic Empire could have invented the telescope. Why do you think they didn't?
It's very interesting. I mean, there are many, many. I mean, history's littered with these sorts of examples of the knowledge, the wherewithal is there, but it takes certain geniuses to put two and two together and hit upon ideas that could have been discovered earlier. Very often ideas have been discovered earlier and then forgotten. In terms of optics, Ibn al-Haytham was very much out on his own in terms of his brilliance. There were a few other scholars at the time who were studying lenses, who were studying mirrors. But Ibn al-Haytham, and by the way, I think we're sort of set next year, the world scientific community, the history of science community, are talking about celebrating the 1,000 years since Ibn al-Haytham's optics. We don't know exactly when, but it's roughly, give or take, a few years. It's 1,000 years ago exactly that he wrote his book. It certainly influenced many later European scholars, artists as well as scientists. Ibn al-Haytham himself was probably more interested in sort of the pure, the mathematical physics, the drawing the ray diagrams. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really involved in building lots of different
equipment. So the distinction between experimental physics and theoretical physics is still with us today. It was probably around then as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One of the wonderful reviews I read of your book was by Tim Radford of The Guardian. He's a very seasoned journalist, quite apart from the fact that it's a very very detailed review. It's very lyrically written, wonderfully written. But he concludes the review by saying, in 2005, scientists from 17 Arab countries produced 13,444 scientific publications. Harvard University alone that year produced 15,455. Is that an appropriate yardstick to measure the state of Arabic science?
It's difficult. I mean, certainly Arabic science, science in the Arab world, science in the wider Muslim world, is still very much in stagnation. And a lot of things are changing very quickly. A lot of money is being poured in, certainly the Gulf states. Iran and Turkey and Egypt are making great strides. Malaysia, Nigeria pouring money in. But the way we define the scientific worth of a nation is, rightly or wrongly, in terms of their publications. Probably more accurately would be to consider the citation. So how many times a particular scientific paper is referred to by others. And even on that scale, there's very few countries in the Islamic world today that figure highly. So they have their work cut out to sort of regain past glories.
It's not a financial issue anymore. There's a fair bit of cash out there in that part of the world, so it's just a cultural and
infrastructural issue. What I say in the last chapter of my book, where I explore the state of science in the Islamic world today, is that it's not enough to pour money into sciences. You can build this wonderful, shiny laboratory with all this excellent equipment, but you still need to overhaul sort of some of the infrastructure within research laboratories and universities. You still need the people there who understand how to use the equipment, who have this free-thinking sense of inquiry, which they had 1,000 years ago. And there's still, to some extent, in the Islamic world, an anti-science sort of feeling. Sometimes it's seen as a Western construct, as though it's some sort of a secular thing that might be viewed as somehow un-Islamic. But things are changing very quickly, and there are people in place now who have their hearts and minds in the right place.
If you put your other hat on, your professor of public understanding in science, if you go back about 20 or 30 years ago, there were people like Jacob Bronowski, Carl Sagan, and many others. And interestingly, if you look at the press, the people who are around today, you know, there's yourself, Brian Cox, there's many others. But what's interesting is they're always introduced, either if it's a radio program, a TV series, or a book, with their title. So it's a doctor or a professor. That didn't used to be the case if you look at the books from 20, 30 years ago. Is science its back foot? Is it have to defend itself with that authority in the titles?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, I certainly think, certainly in the last 10, 15 years, science communication has changed dramatically. So when I first started giving public lectures, going talking to schools, writing the odd newspaper magazine article, it was very much frowned upon that if you're research active and and you were publishing papers and getting research grants and going to conferences, colleagues within academia would say, that's an aside, as a hobby. The important thing is to do the research. Things have changed dramatically now, and so it's a respectable part of a scientist's job to explain, justify why they're spending public money, try and infuse and inspire the next generation. So I think science communication has moved great strides forward. I don't see it as a negative or a bad thing that we're having to say, look, I am a professional scientist, I'm a professor, therefore you should listen to me. I do think it's a good thing that science documentaries are fronted by active researchers, as opposed to someone interested in science, as an amateur. Uh-huh. It sort of gives credibility to the sort of thing that we're saying. So I don't mind that.
Yeah. And just to conclude, I know you've done the book, you've done the SciPod, your own podcast, and of course the many TV series you have been doing and are doing. I hope, particularly with the Arabic pathfinders, the Arabic Empire, there's, in some ways, that work only you could have done. Somebody from Baghdad, now in Surrey. And I hope you don't think your work is done. Unfortunately, I think you are in an ideal place to do a lot more, and you will hopefully continue.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I was warned that, as a theoretical physicist, moving into this realm of the history of science, and particularly the science of the Islamic world, I may become better known as someone commenting on that subject rather than on my theoretical physics. But it's a hugely important job, and I'm relishing being more further immersed in this area. So yes, I appreciate there's some sort of weight on my shoulders to get across these ideas.
And I know from your recent timetable that is quite demanding, and I'm very grateful for you taking your time out for this recording. Professor Al-Khalili, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The quote for this episode is from Chapter 2 of Pathfinders. It's from the Prophet Muhammad. The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr.